Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, Clark County voters overwhelmingly approved a $120 million continuation of the 1% sales tax to fund education improvements. We'll find out what school district officials have planned for the new revenue.
We're looking at building a brand new Clark Middle, which is going to be great for that particular community.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Also today, ACC commissioners got a look at an updated list of potential T-SPLOS projects. Our panel talks about what made the first cut.
A lot of stuff in North Athens and East Athens has made it on, so that's wonderful.
Plus, how one combat veteran is turning to farming to help heal his trauma.
Those stories and much more coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition goes to the source, to the people affected by the news.
This plant could shut down, and a lot of very good people could lose their jobs.
Like this, it's completely ridiculous that we should feel unsafe to go to school.
I'm Noelle King. For stories that matter to you, listen every weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup. Clark County voters overwhelmingly approved a $120 million continuation of the county E-SPLOST, the Education Special Purpose Local Option Sales Tax. So what are school district officials planning to do with the new money? With us today to discuss new school construction and more is the Chief of Operations for the Clark County School District, Dexter Fisher. Welcome to Athens News Matters.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Really appreciate the fact that you all have me on your program this morning.
Well, great. Well, first, can you tell us a little bit about the history of E-SPLOST in Athens? How long has it been around and what projects has it funded in the past?
Well, E-SPLOST has been around for almost over 20 plus years. Interesting enough, E-SPLOST was started initially is to help fund projects, and those projects be like building new schools, renovations, HVAC upgrades, technology purchases, buses. Some of the major projects that we have done in the past, we built a new Hillsman Middle School, built new Barnett Shoals, Overthorpe Elementary, and Whitehead Elementary School. We did major renovations at Barnett Harris Middle School, Core Middle, Cedar, and Clark Central High Schools. Last several years, those have been some of the major projects that we have done in the Clark County School District.
Well, what projects can we expect this round of E-SPLOST to fund?
For this round, we're looking at building a brand new Clark Middle, which is going to be great for that particular community. Also, we're looking at doing major renovations and additions to Cedar Shoals High School, Gaines Elementary, Apps Road Elementary, and Cleveland Road Elementary. Mm-hmm. On top of that, we're also looking at doing some major maintenance upgrades in some of our schools. Of course, we'll look at those projects and look at those schools, see what the major needs are, and we'll start those projects.
Well, which of the projects at this point look like they have top priority?
Well, of course, Clark Middle is going to be our first major project out of the ground. We have already put together a building committee of parents, community volunteers, the administration over at Clark Middle. So we have already started that process for what that school would look like, what teachers think are the best for them to teach in their classrooms. So from a plan standpoint, we have already started the planning process for Clark Middle.
And when you say an advisement group, so you guys have sort of huddled up with parents and teachers alike to sort of get feedback on how to build this thing.
Yes, sir, exactly. And we want that because, again, especially with our teachers and the administration in the building, they know what's best for their need, what their classroom need to look like, what the seating need to look like, what even what the design or how we go to the cafeteria need to look like. So we're going to build that school based on the feedback along with the architects that we'll be working with to feedback that parents, teachers, and administrators will want Clark Middle School to look like.
And just staying with the Clark Middle project, what kind of timeline should parents expect? I mean, looking down the road, when would something like this be done, you think?
So that project would probably be a 3 to 4 year project. What we'll do, because since the splash has passed, we'll start collecting those revenues next year. Once we start collecting those revenues, we'll go ahead and we'll borrow the money. Once we get the funds started with the collections, because we'll pay those bonds back, and then the process will start. So probably about a 3 year process based on, you know, getting the materials in and getting everything started. So probably 3 year, no more than a 4 year process. I can tell you every project that we have done since we started the SPLASH program from 20 years ago, it came in under time, and most of the part under budget. So we really watch how we spend those dollars that the taxpayers in this community have graciously allowed us to do.
Well, who actually decides what eSPLOST will fund, and what factors go into that decision?
Well, what we do a 5-year sort of strategic plan, and we look at the schools. You know, most schools, most educators will have a 20 to 30 year life cycle. So we look at the life cycle of all our schools. Based on how long that school has been standing, we look at what may need be done. It could be a major renovation, or it could be a Clark Miller. Clark Miller is our oldest middle school in this district, so we knew it was time for us to build a brand new Clark Miller.
Dexter Fisher is the chief of operations for the Clark County School District.
I'm James Menendez. In a time of fast-developing news and headlines, NewsHour is there to help you make sense of a complex world.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. You will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Again, another huge development.
That's NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters, and I'm Alexia Ridley. On Tuesday, Athens Clark County Commissioners discussed possible transportation projects that could be funded by TSPLOS 2023. The Citizens Advisory Committee had vetted $700 million worth of proposals submitted by Athens residents and winnowed them down to the list of about 150% of the total expected TSPLOS revenue. The committee's next task will be to cut that list down even further so that the final recommended set of projects will total about $144 million. Here to talk about that, plus the rest of the weekend news, are Chris Dowd with Athens Politics Nerd and Gwen O'Looney with WXAG. So several commissioners seem concerned that pavement maintenance wasn't included on this list, even though the county staff had requested over $70 million for pavement projects. Gwen, let's start with you and your thoughts on that.
Well, pavement traditionally is our job out of general fund, and it's been very progressive lately. We've got a lot of money we have not spent from the last DSPOS on pavement, and I love this list. I think they've done a great job doing the necessities under maintaining maintenance, and that's the bridge improvement program and the culvert and live stream and the stormwater roads and bridges. Those things, they're taking a major part of it. The other thing is that they're covering the cost of some longstanding commitments and getting them done. And I love the fact that 42 of these projects are community-led submissions. So this is an advisory group that has done a great job of caring about locations throughout the community, catching up in areas that have not gotten a lot of attention, and looking at our long-term commitments.
Yeah, I completely agree, Gwen. I think this is a great list. And it's just really wonderfully democratic that we have all of these, citizen submitted projects that are making it on the list. A lot of stuff in North Athens and East Athens has made it on. So that's wonderful. I'm a little worried about not including the pavement maintenance on there because there's so much money that they need for that. And I'm not sure how else we're going to fund that. So I imagine that the commission's going to put on at least some of that back on in TSPLOST, and I don't know what they're going to take out. So it remains to be seen how much of this great stuff will stay in there because, it is a 150% list right now. So they have to take out, that 50% and then maybe even more to put pavement maintenance back in. So we'll see what the final list looks like, but it's looking great right now.
Right. One thing that always worries me, although I'm not surprised and I don't disagree, but College Square was not included. And that is a project underway that needs to be finished and a top level of quality. So I'm hoping the commissioners recognize that we as citizens need to take more responsibility for some of these projects and not depend solely on TSPLOST and ESPLOST and SPLOST.
Yeah, they were asking for like $8 million, I think, for the College Square one. And that I wish they had a smaller version of that project, because I think we could do a lot of great stuff in there for like $3 or $4 million. So I'm not sure why they needed so much money for it. But yeah, I think that's why I got cut out. But yeah, I like that one too a lot. I hope they find a way to fund that.
One of the things you guys did touch on, obviously the pavement maintenance, that was a big chunk of money. What are advantages and disadvantages to using TSPLOST money toward maintaining county roads?
Obviously, we're kind of over committing our community if we are dependent upon monies that are short-term rather than a long-term budgeting program. That has been our past, is that we have included, along with state monies, which have disappeared, and they gave us this TSPLOST. So the gas tax has never been distributed fairly by the state. There are lots of alternatives that can be changed on the local and the state level.
Yeah, I guess an advantage to putting it in on TSPLOST is that it'll get done. I mean, and a disadvantage would be, they want like $72 million for it. So, that's like half the TSPLOST. So I don't know how this, we have to figure out how to fund this because this is, neither way seems to be working to me.
Was there anything else in the discussion about those TSPLOST projects that stood out to either of you?
Well, I was glad to see that they supported the West Broad roundabout. I think that we've got a good plan. It's not invasive. It's really one of the lower cost plans. And I was glad to see that they funded that completion.
There's one project I was a little sad about that they didn't include, which was number 26 for transit operations and maintenance facility, and also three transfer stations sort of around the county, which I think would really improve the efficiency of the transit system. So I hope we find a way to fund that, maybe in the infrastructure bill that was just passed. I'm not sure.
I agree with that. But I do think that the transit has been very aggressive in seeking national funding. And like, for instance, a number of the buses that were funded last time under TSPLOST, we found monies for and were able to reallocate that money. This is an excellent opportunity for them. Those transfer stations and our obvious commitment to transit would be great attractors of federal money.
And let's go back to the roundabout at West Broad and Hancock. I know for a lot of people, this is sort of a dreaded intersection. And this project really has been in the works for some time, hasn't it?
Well, it takes about 7 years for traffic or highway improvements to occur because they require a lot of planning, a lot of property acquisition, approvals along the way, et cetera. So in a way, this project has moved pretty quickly. It's been thought about forever, but our actual implementation has not been that long to me.
There have been some earlier designs for it that weren't as good and people had some issues with. And I'm almost glad that they spoke up, because the current design looks great. I'm really thrilled by it. So there are some issues with, there's a stream running through the intersection that they didn't want to impact. And then one of the earlier designs had them closing off the plaza, which was a big deal breaker for the people on that street. So the current design doesn't impact the stream. It leaves the plaza open, and it just looks really cool. And I can't wait for this to get implemented.
Right. It gives a lot of access to new areas, new credentials, you might say, to new neighborhoods carefully. I agree with Chris.
And there'll be a crosswalk when this is finished. So right now you can't cross that road. It's impossible. And but now there'll be a crosswalk. So there'll be a way to legally cross this busy road. And it'll slow down traffic. So it'll be a lot safer to do that.
A crosswalk, it's like that's a big thing, because as Chris said, nothing there. And it just seems like it's going to really ease things.
Yeah, roundabouts. I mean, I was happy with the earlier designs because I just like roundabouts, because they're just a lot safer, and they actually move the traffic through, you know, more quickly. I mean, the cars slow down, but more cars actually go through, you know, per unit time, so per minute or whatever. So I just like roundabouts in general, but this particular design, I think it just looks amazing. I just, the extra work they did on it really shows.
Right. I'm hoping that they don't ruin this roundabout with the amount of signage that they tend to put right in the middle. If you go out Millage to the new roundabout at Whitehall, you know, there's just no need. They really are insulting at how much they tell you. And most communities put signs way before the roundabout. Our community, they just put them all. Tallahassee is the same way. So these roundabouts can be very attractive, efficient, and effective traffic installations, but they don't have to be ugly.
Another really quick benefit of roundabouts is that they're low tech. They don't require any electricity. Like, so when the lights go out, it's still perfectly safe. You don't have to have a traffic light there. I just like them a lot.
And you don't have a bunch of cars sitting there with their exhaust polluting. They are, Chris is right. It's a very environmentally correct way to do things.
And yeah, you're right. There's traffic never has to stop at a roundabout. It just flows.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're going to move to the state level. And Georgia lawmakers are back in Atlanta this week. And they've drawn some criticism for the redistricting process so far. So I guess, what stage are we on right now in the House, Senate, and congressional map?
Just this week, they passed the House map, which has Athens split up into four pieces, which is, I mean, I knew it was going to be bad, but I was not really prepared for this four-piece jigsaw puzzle that I'm looking at right now. This is a bitter pill to swallow, definitely. I think for anyone who cares about democracy, because there's just, this is probably going to keep the Republican Party in control of, you know, the state house probably for 10 years, I think. I mean, I'm not sure how that, definitely this gets rid of any hope of having, you know, a second Democratic state house representative in Athens. Like, it'll just be Spencer Fry, and that's it. There's no way we can win these districts. I hate to say that, but and I would hope even Republicans who, you know, care about our Republican form of government here, this is not good for any voter at all, because it takes away the power of our vote, no matter what party you're in. And it's good for all politicians, because, you know, I'm sure Spencer Fry hates this map, but he has a safe seat now. Like, you know, no one wants to run a competitive election every 2 years. No politician does, because it's very draining. So this is great for politicians on in both parties, and it's bad for voters in both parties.
That's right. It's also bad for our state, because our state is beginning to vote more and more democratically. And to have a split administration, legislation, that sort of thing would put us, I mean, if we're not careful, we'll move into the kind of stalemate that we're seeing on the national level. I agree with everything Chris said. I also, you know, at one point there was one map that the, I think it was the Senate that looked at, that had Athens as one entity. And I knew that there was no way they had the guts to pass that one.
Yeah, on the state Senate side, we're still split into two pieces. It's not as bad of a map as the state House districts, but, right. But yeah, we're still split into two pieces on that one.
Right. Then our Georgia election officials are very upset. A majority of our counties in the state ask the legislature to not implement this for the November vote, because it was going to be so confusing and hard for them to be prepared. And that's going to be especially true for Athens-Clarke County voters.
Another criticism these maps have gotten is that, you know, there's been a big increase in the minority population in the last 10 years, and that's not represented in these maps at all. There aren't any more majority-minority districts than there were before, even though the population is so much higher. So yeah, it's just, they're just not good maps for anybody, you know, except the Republican politicians, I guess. That's it.
We're out of time for the panel this week, but of course, stay with us. We'll have more Athens News Matters after the break.
All Things Considered has been there through controversial wars.
Thousands of young people came to Washington.
National disasters.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
The explosion in the clear blue Florida
and breakthrough
sky.
Moments.
Just let it sink in. An African American president of the United States of America.
4 decades of bringing you the news on All Things Considered every afternoon.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup. 3 of every 4 Americans who now serve in the military signed up after the September 11 terror attacks. This post-9/11 generation of warriors is twice as likely as their older counterparts to serve in a combat zone. That means they're also more likely than older soldiers to carry trauma in body and in spirit. During this Veterans Day week, reporter-producer Allison Salerno introduces us to a Georgia combat veteran who has found an unconventional way to heal, through farming. Please be aware, some of this story includes accounts and descriptions that may not be suitable for all listeners.
There's always an enemy. Improvised explosive devices would get destroyed tanks. You know, we're getting complex ambushes and grenades, RPGs, a lot of gunfire going on.
John Jackson came home from war with a traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. He came home feeling numb and disconnected. Eventually, he became so distressed, he wanted to take his life. Instead, he thought about what would make him happy. He bought land in Middle Georgia and started farming. Jackson and Rob Collins have never met, but Collins was a gunner on a Humvee, just like Jackson. When Collins came home from Iraq, he went to Kennesaw State University and then the University of Georgia for a master's in social work. Now he teaches about resilience for Chris 180, a DeKalb County nonprofit.
Oftentimes when you look at a behavior of somebody that has experienced significant trauma, you can trace it back a little bit to an environment where that would be successful. And that would be successful in combat. You really have to kind of numb yourself. I did the same thing. So you have to have that kind of emotional numbness just to be able to do your job.
For Jackson, overcoming that numbness and reconnecting with his family began after he and his wife saved a lamb.
it had bloat, and we just quick Googled it was at night, and we're sitting there grabbing olive oil and shoving it down this throat, and we're like massaging his belly, and it's burping, and then all of a sudden it's alive now, and it's something that me and her did together, and it was, wow, these connections started forming. I found myself wanting to be around my family a whole lot more.
In 2014, Jackson created a nonprofit with 20-acre Comfort Farms as its first venture. Veterans in immediate crisis work for days or weeks while they wait for treatment with the Veterans Administration. He recalls his first winter on the farm and how he realized he couldn't and didn't need to control everything in order to be okay.
You know, there was a time where, you know, it was super extremely cold. And I come to the farm and I just want to feed pigs, feed the animals, go work in the greenhouse because I had my list. I go in, I'm riding up to the farm. And I see nothing but water spouts and freezing water spigots everywhere because hoses have busted. And I realized that everything that I wanted to do that day could not be done that day. You know, it forced me to just say, well, that's what I was going to do. I can't do that now. This is what I need to do. What it forced me to do was understand that I have to be flexible.
The Saturday I visited, John and his wife had friends over. Many of the men were combat veterans, also scarred by war, people who have found meaning and purpose in farming. John talked to me about his day.
Today, I sat up on the top of the hill over our sweat lodge this morning with probably about 20 of our closest friends who we work with all year that are throughout here, many of them vets. And we just had quiet time just listening to every single bird. It was so the amplifying of every single bird that was there that you would not even hear if you're just having a conversation with one another. Being able to sit in silence, being able to unthink from people who have a problem shutting it off is huge. And the only way that we can do that is through nature and just be in the moment. That's it. That's it. Just be.
The fields of okra and corn that John Jackson works on his farm outside Milledgeville are thousands of miles away from the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan. But the trauma he brought home from overseas is still all too close to home. But Jackson, like the veterans he helps, hopes that forging a new connection with the land will make his PTSD as remote as the battlefields he left behind years ago. For WUGA News, I'm Allison Salerno.
On our website, wuga.org, you can find photographs of John Jackson on his farm and more. And if you or someone you know is having thoughts of suicide, reach out to a mental health professional or call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's open 24 hours every day with help in both Spanish and English. The number is 800-273-8255. Trust in science is declining, but in today's changing media landscape, how can scientists rebuild credibility with the public? Here to share some ideas is Dr. Glenn Nowak, professor and co-director of the Center for Health and Risk Communication at UGA's Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication, along with WUGA's own science and research correspondent from UGA's College of Public Health, Lauren Baggett. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
So, Lauren, you want to go ahead and kick us off on how misinformation has been troubling in a lot of ways for scientists.
Right. So some have said that trust in science has been undermined by the spread of misinformation and sometimes disinformation related to COVID-19 and before this a number of other topics. Would you say that that's a fair statement?
There's been surveys that have suggested that people trust scientists, but they don't trust the recommendations, right? And so I think one of the challenges has always been with science, and I think scientists have probably not been quick to recognize that, is that the major thing that happens when you do scientific research is at the end of your paper, where you talk about, and now what should be done as a result of my findings. And I think that's where scientists get themselves into public policy debates and the world of competing values, competing ideologies, because some people would look at your findings and say your findings are perfect. I accept your findings. I don't accept your recommendations. I don't trust the reasons behind or your motives behind those recommendations. And I think that's been one of the biggest challenges when it comes to trust is people are uncertain about why should I cede authority to scientists on some of these issues that cut across social values and have economic impact.
And that's been a shift for people, right? In the last couple of decades, there used to be much more trust in scientists and doctors and these figures of authority. What might be behind some of that shifting trust?
Well, I think one of the reasons behind the shifting trust is scientists who are working on big issues like climate change, vaccines, they need public policy recommendations that are quite big. And as a result, they're now intersecting with politicians and elected officials in ways that they probably have never done before. And once you get into that political realm, you now have competing political ideologies and priorities. I think another factor is that there isn't necessarily a lot of as much consensus as we imagined among scientists and experts. And so that can create problems because people will say, why is there misinformation? Well, some of that misinformation is out there because experts have different views. And I think a third reason, as we have seen with COVID-19, is the science changes and it can change rapidly. So what you know today and you're using as the basis for your recommendations can change next week and as a result make you change your recommendation. And people find that quite confusing.
So then how can scientists learn to communicate better?
Well, I think one, it's first of all recognizing that even if you have really sound findings, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to succeed in the realm of public opinion or with political leaders. So you have to continue to figure out how do we work better with elected officials and with the public. I think there's been some efforts also underway to try to get people to understand that science is dynamic, to get comfortable with the fact that science changes, and that's a good thing.
You've mentioned politicians, other policymakers being part of a conversation along with scientists, but then with the advent of social media, you now have citizens, just social media users who can add to a conversation. So how do listeners become more critical of the information that they may see on these platforms when they're trying to make a decision or make a judgment call about an important issue related to their health?
That's going to be an ongoing challenge, I think, going forward. We did a survey in 2020, and we just submitted a manuscript. And one of the things that we found, which was kind of surprising, was that people who said they took a balanced approach to seeking information on COVID actually were the least certain about what they should do. People who basically said, no, I'm focusing primarily on liberal media or I'm focusing primarily on conservative media, they were much more definitive in their beliefs. And so I think one of the things that we thought, at least I thought, was that if you took a balanced approach, you might end up with a better knowledge base. And I think what that suggests is that that may not be the case. I think in a lot of instances, if it affects your health, it's going to be having conversations with your healthcare provider. Now, I say that with the caveat that, you know, that's a lot of pressure on healthcare professionals because they have to be up to date. And again, what that may mean for public health is developing better resources for healthcare providers, doctors, and nurses, so that they are able to have those conversations with patients.
Well, Dr. Nowak, thank you for being here with us.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Glenn Nowak is Associate Dean for Research and Grad Studies and Co-Director for Health and Risk Communication at UGA's Grady College. And of course, Lauren Baggett is WUGA's Health and Science Correspondent and the Communications Director at UGA's College of Public Health.
You know that feeling where you're exhausted by the news, but you also can't stay away from the news? I am here to help with that. My name is Sam Sanders. My show is called It's Been a Minute. Every week, journalists and I process the week of news and culture in a way that doesn't feel overwhelming. Listen to It's Been a Minute every week from NPR.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Recently, more and more Americans have been having heated discussions about
critical race theory.
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 Critical race theory, or CRT, has popped up on the news, in school board meetings, and even as a campaign issue in last week's Virginia governor's race.
And while opponents paint CRT as a looming educational evil
that vilifies white people and demands they apologize,
it is a lie, and it is every bit as racist as the Klansmen in white sheets.
These are my babies, not yours. If you are embarrassed or ashamed of your skin color, that's your issue, not mine nor my children.
Critical race theory is racism.
Many in the academic world would say those opponents are misunderstanding, in some cases willfully, what critical race theory actually is.
It is a theory. It is a lens by which to view history.
Critical race theory is not so much a thing. It's a way of looking at a thing.
One local voice that has entered this challenging conversation is the Athens Anti-Discrimination Movement, which has been hosting what it calls Teach the Truth Thursdays with academics, activists, and educators. Recently, I spoke with Amelia Wheeler, co-facilitator of the series and a PhD student in social studies education at the University of Georgia, about the events and what the AADM hopes to accomplish. Here's our conversation. What is this series?
Teach the Truth Thursdays is a series of professional development for teachers designed to equip them with content knowledge for instructing students on topics such as racism, structural oppression, as well as movements for liberation and resistance in the face of those structures.
So what's lacking right now in this area of education and how it's being taught?
There's a few ways to think about answering that question. Overall, I think the three things that T3 Thursdays is really hoping to provide the community is, one, a community for educators to plug into where they can feel supported and they can feel emboldened to take on this really brave work instead of isolated and fearful of retaliation. I think number two, we're really hoping that this serves as a place for teachers to learn the actual truth of history, which is incredibly marred by racism, structural oppression, and so on. And then number three, we're hoping to kind of right this omission in school that essentially has functioned to keep the truth from our students about the prevalence of racism and its functioning in our society.
I know that you guys have an organization supportive of teachers, but there is the possibility, I would assume, of pushback since this is above and beyond the state curriculum.
Exactly, Alexia. And what you have just identified is really the catch-22 of how this all operates. Like, as a former classroom teacher, I was told all the time that, you know, the standards are just guidelines to be built off of. So often that is the narrative that our state lawmakers will use when there is incredible amount of evidence that they leave out critical discussions of racism and sexism. They leave out mention of people of color in a substantive way in general. They leave out mention of women. So the narrative is, well, the standards are the bare bones that teachers are welcome to build upon. And in the same breath, the narrative is, if you can't say, well, I'm presenting this content because it's in the state standards, you are now positioned in a vulnerable place. There could be pushback because it's, quote unquote, not in the standards. Kind of puts the onus on the teacher to make themselves vulnerable in the discussion of these topics.
There's some pressure there.
Yes.
Tell me, who is involved in this?
So I am the co-facilitator along with my other co-facilitator, Chaplain Cole Knapper. Chaplain Cole Knapper is a civil rights organizer from here in town. So we came together after I helped organize a Teach the Truth rally earlier this school year. We reached out to our network and saying, you know, who can help us teach this history to teachers that they might not know? And who can help us teach teachers how to engage these topics in substantive ways in their classroom that are sensitive and thoughtful for the students who are in the class? Our planning committee had university professors, had university graduate students who study these topics in education. We had longtime community leaders on our board, as well as practicing teachers in Athens. And so what we decided is that each one of our professional developments would be led by a member of our planning committee, because we wanted our committee to showcase their strengths and talents that they've really cultivated in addressing these topics in their own work and bring it to classroom teachers. We share a commitment for teaching the truth in Athens schools, and that we understand this as the way forward towards a more racially just society.
I know you guys are about halfway through, but can people still attend? And who can attend?
Yes, thank you so much for asking. That in no means means that you can't still sign up. First of all, I want everyone to know, whether you're a teacher or whether you're a community member, Teach the Truth Thursdays definitely will welcome you with open arms. You do not need to have attended any of the previous sessions to engage deeply, so they're designed as standalone sessions. Know that this has been designed for classroom teachers. We've had a significant turnout of people from the lay community, so people from the criminal justice system, people working in our libraries, people working white-collar jobs, I think are realizing that they were really robbed of the opportunity to learn this truth in their own school careers, and so they're coming and learning right alongside our teachers. And we're really hoping to continue to get the word out for people to come to these last few sessions so they can really learn the truth about how racism continues to function and structure our reality, whether we're classroom teachers or whether we're talking with our partners or our children or our spouses. We can teach the truth and to really push forward the possibility of a racially just future.
Thank you so much. This has been great information. And these are free sessions.
Yes, these are free sessions. A huge shout out to Athens Anti-Discrimination Movement for putting in a tremendous amount of resources to offer this for free to the community and to teachers. Yes.
Amelia Wheeler is the co-facilitator for Teach the Truth Thursdays and a PhD student at UGA. For more information about the series, go to aadmovement.org. Thanksgiving is just around the corner, and while many of us might have had a scaled-down or even virtual Thanksgiving last year, this year, many are looking forward to the full in-person family experience again. But how do you keep family and food from turning into a family feud? Here to help us answer that is Dr. Dawn Randall, a marriage and family therapist here in Athens. Dr. Randall, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So first of all, why do the holidays sometimes bring out the worst in us when it comes to our family?
Partly it's because people have high expectations about what's going to happen. And we all look at the holidays as a time when ordinary life kind of gets set aside. And we're going to relax, and we're going to have time with family that we don't often see. And then we're disappointed at the way it turns out.
It seems very easy for family discussions with people you haven't spent time with during the whole year, and you meet for a few hours or several hours, maybe a few days, in confined spaces. You can turn to an argument real quick.
Right. The confined space is often a problem. How do you get away? And if you're an introvert, that makes it even harder.
Many family arguments seem to center around one thing, and that's politics. If you see a political argument brewing between relatives of different opinions, how do you recommend diffusing that situation?
It's hard sometimes to know exactly what to do because we're afraid of hurting feelings. And I think the thing to remember is that if a situation has escalated to a conflict, that you already have hurt feelings. So taking action is probably the thing to do. If we could back up a step, I would ask the question why a person feels the need to escalate to such an extent. And the answer to that is probably as varied as there are people. But in my line of work, working with families, I realize that people act and behave out of emotional need as well as logical need. So a lot of arguments get started on a logical basis, and then they start bleeding over into the emotional side. So if we find that one person has become too aggressive verbally, then the thing to do is to want to diffuse the situation to help that person calm down. So what are some strategies that we can use? And one is to ask questions. Well, I can see you feel strongly about that. Could you tell me more about how you feel? Why do you feel so strongly? Or if they're not even rational, you might just say, I want to understand how you're feeling, and I can see that you're getting more and more worked up. Is that going to get your point across? Which is a real hook, because people really do want to win. And if what they're doing is not getting their point across, then they're going to look for a different alternative.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Dr. Dawn Randall is a licensed marriage and family therapist based in Athens. You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Gene Davis, Devin Zwald, Robin Whetstone, Kara Nelson, and Abby Buston. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Don't forget to listen back or share our reporting with others. You can find all of our work online at wuga.org. And we'd love for you to follow us at WUGA-FM on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup. As always, thanks for listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Have a great weekend and stay with WUGA for local, state, national, and global news throughout the week.